I invite your attention to Ruth chapter 1. Reading this morning from Ruth chapter 1, verses 1 through 18. I want to take this opportunity to thank each of you who prayed for my wife and I when we were at Rhodes Grove. I can honestly say I never entered the pulpit some of those evenings with a heavier burden, and yet I never experienced a greater freedom to carry out what God had placed upon that heart of mine. And that is only through an answer, that is a result of the blessing of God through prayer. Everyone who has stood in the pulpit knows what I'm talking about that freedom. And so I thank each of you for your prayers during that time that God's will would be done there. This morning, reading from Ruth chapter 1, verses 1 through 18. Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. And the name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi, and the name of his two sons Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah. And they came into the country of Moab and continued there. And Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left, and her two sons, and they took them wives of the women of Moab. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth, and they dwelled there about 10 years. And Mahlon and Chilion died, also both of them, and the woman was left of her two sons and her husband. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law, that she might return from the country of Moab. For she had heard in the country of Moab how that the Lord had visited his people in giving them bread. Wherefore she went forth out of the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on the way to return unto the land of Judah. And Naomi said unto her two daughters-in-law, Go, return each of to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you, as ye have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant you that ye may find rest, each of you in the house of her husband. Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voice and wept. And they said unto her, Surely we will return with thee unto thy people. And Naomi said, Turn again, my daughters, why will ye go with me? Are there yet any more sons in my womb, that they may be your husbands? Turn again, my daughters, go your way. For I am too old to have a husband, for I should say, if I should say I have hope, if I should have a husband also tonight, and should also bear sons, would ye tarry for them till they were grown? Would ye stay for them from having husbands? Nay, my daughters, for it grieveth me much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord is gone out against me. And they lifted up their voice and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clave unto her. And she said, Behold, thy sister-in-law is gone back unto her people and unto her gods. Return thou after thy sister-in-law. And Ruth said, Entreat me not to leave thee, or to return from following after thee. For whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God shall be my God. Where thou diest, will I die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if aught but death part thee and me. When she saw that she was steadfastly minded to go with her, then she left speaking unto her. All who are able, let's kneel for prayer.
I thank Brother Ray for his comments this morning. I like the words of the Apostle Paul. The love of Christ constrains us. He says, I also am just flesh, and I preach these messages, and I preach to myself as well. I've been working on this revival for a number of years, thinking about messages that I might want to preach. I've been preaching at Hades, the same things that I'm going to be preaching here. And whenever I was contacted and Brother Ray asked me for a list of sermons, I prayed and I looked over the things that I had preached in the past, and I was trying to decide what it was that the Lord was laying on my heart for these services. And so, I don't really understand. If you look at the revival card, maybe some of those things you'll think, well, that's not really a revival sermon. But I think they are. And I picked out messages that I believe the Lord was speaking to me about. And as I looked over those titles, I saw this theme about faith. Growing in faith. And we have, these are revival services. They're evangelistic services, but they're also revival services. And there's messages that deal with people who are unsaved, but there's messages there for those who have been saved for a long time. We all stumble. We all need encouragement. We need recommitment, rededication. I want to thank you all for your prayers. Many of you have said to me that you've been praying for me. I wasn't nervous a week ago, but whenever I was coming down here this morning, I was kind of shook up, and it's a big responsibility, and I do appreciate your prayers. Brother Ray introduced my wife. I have two daughters. Katrina is 14. She'll be 15 next week. Not this coming week, but the next week. And Danielle was 11. We are glad to have them with us. They won't be here every night this week, but we appreciate having them whenever they can be here. I make a living working at CopyQuick, a printing shop in Hagerstown, Maryland. I've been there for 18 years, run a printing press. Whenever I started, there was four of us running presses, but the printing industry continues to change, especially for a small company. I'm the only person who runs a press anymore, and I don't keep busy running a press all the time, but that is my occupation. I hope you enjoy this theme song as I picked it out. I was really kind of hoping to pick a song that was not in the Brother and Hymnal, and I was hoping to pick one that maybe you would not be quite as familiar with. But as I looked, I picked out a lot of songs and I looked at the messages. I decided that this one was going to be appropriate. It would hopefully be fun to sing, enjoyable to sing. We'd not get tired of singing it. And I think it has a good message for us. I took a class a few years ago with a ministry class, and the subject was praise and worship. And for one of the homework assignments, I was asked to interview a local pastor about changes that he had seen in worship over the past 50 years. So I chose to talk to Leon Yoder from the Greencastle Church of the Brethren. I asked him whether he felt that worship in general had improved or declined in past years. His response was that there has been a decline. He said, people are more self-centered and shallow and less committed to Christ and the church today than they were 50 years ago. And because they're less involved, they lack that sense of community and belonging that ought to be a part of our church experience. Later, I asked him about the problems that the church is facing today, and he said, a total lack of commitment to anything at all. A selfish, self-centered attitude rather than a self-sacrificial one. He said, we will rarely see value in something that doesn't cost us anything. Commitment takes on a variety of forms. One commitment that many people make sometime during their lives is a commitment to marriage. They make a vow to remain faithful to each other for as long as they both shall live. Yet statistics show that 50% of marriages will end in divorce. And why does that happen? Something outlasted their level of commitment. Many people feel like they had a good reason, or even that that was the only choice that they were left with under the circumstances. But if their commitment would have been stronger, those excuses would not have seemed so good. People lack commitment to their jobs. More than 18 years ago, I used to work at L&S Stern, and we used to get paid then on Thursdays. Then management noticed that too many employees were not coming to work the next day, and so they changed their policy to pay on Friday. Christians lack commitment to their fellow Christians and lack commitment to their responsibilities in church. I think that we need to realize that if we want to receive any worthwhile blessings from being a part of the church, it's going to cost us something. In Joshua 24, just before his death, Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel around him, and he remembered God's care throughout their history from Abraham to the present time. And in verse 15, he challenged them to choose who they would serve. Right now, today, choose who you will serve. And Joshua made a commitment. As for me and my house, he said, we will serve the Lord. In Daniel 1:8, we find that Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with a portion of the king's meat or with the wine which he drank. Commitment is having a goal for our lives, setting a goal, and then daily and faithfully pursuing that goal. Commitment is most difficult and it's most easily seen during tough times. How we weather the storm clearly demonstrates our basic beliefs. Prove that you can remain faithful and steadfast when it would be easier to quit. Some of you are familiar with the name Vince Lombardi. He's widely regarded as perhaps the greatest coach. He was a football coach, but maybe the greatest coach to ever coach sports. He once said, "The difference between a successful person and all the others is not a lack of strength. It's not a lack of knowledge, but rather it's a lack of will." Commitment is not having a foolproof plan. It's not being prepared for whatever comes, but it's simply an unwillingness to accept failure. There's a big problem in the world today with people who lack commitment. And too often we find those problems in the church as well. Several years ago, I preached a series of sermons out of the book of Ruth. And you are familiar with that story. When famine came to the land of Israel, Elimelech decided to move his family to Moab in order to help them to ride out this famine. Boaz, on the other hand, remained in Bethlehem, trusting God to take care of him. Elimelech attempted to save his life by getting away from the trouble that he was facing, and he lost it, while Boaz didn't concern himself with survival. And in doing so, Boaz found life. We noticed how God worked through the decisions of both of those men in order to accomplish his greater plan to build a royal family in Israel. This morning we'll be looking at Ruth. And Ruth made a commitment to align herself with Naomi and with the people of God. As we read this story, we see an amazing young woman. I think it's hard to imagine that a heathen people like the Moabites could have produced such a person. But I believe that it all started because Ruth was willing to make a commitment. She decided a path that she would take, and then she would not allow any of the difficulties that she would face to turn her away from that goal. God still needs people like Ruth, and I believe in times like these, he needs them more than ever. So I'd like to look into this passage and see the process of building or developing a commitment. In verses 6 and 7, we see that Naomi made a decision to return to Bethlehem. She began her journey, and her daughters-in-law traveled along with her. They might have had 5 to 10 miles possibly of reasonably good travel in the land of Moab until they reached the border. And during that time, I think Naomi just enjoyed their company. It was kind of a long goodbye, you might say. In verses 8 and 9, they stopped, and Naomi blessed them and kissed them, and she sent them back home. In verse 10, they made a statement about their intention of going back with Naomi. "Surely we will return with thee unto thy people," they said. It sounds, on the surface, it sounds like a commitment, but it was not a commitment. And the reason it was not a commitment is because Orpah was so quickly talked out of it. I believe that they meant well. They had good intentions, but that hardly qualifies as a commitment. Good intentions only last as long as the circumstances are good. But when someone makes a commitment, they will accept no excuses. Traveling had been good that day. The weather was nice. The path was easy. And as long as that continued, they were happy to stay with Naomi. But I'm afraid that this is about as close to commitment as most people ever get. They're kind of like Peter, following Jesus afar off. Close enough to see what's happening, but yet they're far enough away that it's easy to escape if things get uncomfortable. I think wisely, Naomi was not satisfied with their answer. "Why will you go with me?" she asked. She needed to hear something more. She would settle for nothing less than commitment. And so she appealed to reason. Naomi reminded them that they would be much better off. They would have better prospects for a husband if they'd stay in their own country. Did you ever wonder why Naomi would try to talk her daughters-in-law out of going with her? Didn't she believe that her God was the only true God? Surely she knew that for them to return to Moab would mean a return to idolatry and eventually judgment. I'm sure that she knew that. I don't think that she really wanted them to leave her, but she wouldn't allow them to follow her without making a commitment. She may well have seen how God evidenced his power and his care of the people of Israel in the conquest of Canaan, and she also saw how quickly her own people fell away from following God afterwards. She would have heard stories about what happened during the 40 years in the wilderness, and she knew how difficult it was for people then to learn to trust God. She knew that their trip back to Bethlehem would be dangerous, might not even survive. That trip would be about 35 miles from the edge of the plateau down through the Jordan River, the Dead Sea Valley, and back to Bethlehem. The temperatures at the Dead Sea sometimes reached 125 degrees. That area only receives 2 to 4 inches of rain a year, and so fresh water might be a problem. They descended about a mile to the Dead Sea, and they would have to climb back up almost that far to reach Bethlehem, in wilderness that most men would choose to avoid. There were wild animals that lived along the Jordan River, and bands of robbers waiting along the few pathways through this wilderness, just waiting for people just like them, unprotected, old. Naomi did not want these two precious daughters-in-law making a trip with her just for her sake alone. There was no way she could know what troubles they might face, but they needed to want to go to Israel in spite of the potential difficulties. Somebody has said, commitment is healthiest not when it is without doubt, but in spite of that doubt. And notice in this passage how difficult it is to make a commitment. You know, these girls could have just voluntarily made a commitment as they were walking. Naomi tried to get them off the fence, so to speak. These two times, but it didn't work. They were still were not willing to get off. I believe that they wanted to be with Naomi, but making a commitment was just too hard. Look at the tears that they shed. And in the end, Orpah almost made a commitment, but the uncertainty of what lay ahead was just too much, and she turned back. Ruth almost didn't make a commitment. But I think that for her, what she knew about Moab and her old way of life just didn't measure up to what she believed about Naomi and the God of Israel. What lessons could we learn from this account? Again, I just say, how easy would it have been for Naomi to whisper some words of encouragement? I think that a little encouragement is all Orpah would have needed to convince her to join them. Except that's not what she needed. She needed faith and trust in God and a desire to join God's people. Would Orpah have been better off with God's people lacking commitment? Or with the Moabites with no godly influence around her? That's a tough question, but I believe Naomi thought she would be better off in Moab. Just think about it for a minute. When something good happened in Israel, all these godly people all around her get excited and they start praising God. Orpah is skeptical. She would say, that kind of thing happened in Moab too. She would always wonder if she had done the right thing or not. Is this God of Israel really any different from the idols she had worshipped? But then picture Orpah in Moab. Every year, they offer the same sacrifices to a God who doesn't give any indication that he ever hears or sees or responds. Sometimes it rains, sometimes it doesn't. Did it really make any difference? She would wonder whether it was raining in Israel. She'd remember what Naomi said about the interaction, the way that Israel's God actually listened to them and responded to them and judged them whenever they did wrong. Orpah would still be uncommitted in Moab, but it would be her God that she was doubting. And it would be the God of Israel that she was questioning, she was curious about. Perhaps we should make a little more effort to demand commitments of people in the future. Because if we don't accept anything less than commitment, God might still have the opportunity to deal with that person. The Christian life is supposed to be a difficult one. For the founders of the Church of the Brethren and many other Anabaptists and Reformation leaders in their day, to be rebaptized was a death sentence. Naomi wanted commitment, and she wouldn't settle for anything less. And although Orpah turned back, Ruth finally did make a commitment. Let's look at the commitment that Ruth makes. I think as I read this commitment, I think it starts out somewhat simple and basic, but it grew, taking in more distance and more strength, greater depth, and reaching out further into the future. I can picture Ruth's voice being a little shaky and quiet at first, but I think it grew in intensity and power as she continued. She starts out with, "Whither thou goest, I will go." She's thinking here about the journey. She has no idea what danger awaits them. Maybe it just crossed her mind that there was a good chance they wouldn't even make it to Bethlehem. But Ruth would not choose safety in Moab at the expense of never knowing whether Naomi made it safely home or not. She is going to make that trip, or else she'll die trying. She won't run off at the first sign of trouble and abandon Naomi. And then she said, "Where thou lodgest, I will lodge." This is not merely a pledge, then. Her commitment is not just a pledge to get Naomi safely home and then she would hurry back to Moab. She has no intention of leaving as soon as the job is done. She's not thinking about just getting Naomi settled in and getting some meals lined up and then just trusting her to her neighbors. Where Naomi lives would be good enough for Ruth too. Ruth would be around every day, not only to see that Naomi has enough to eat, but she would be eating there as well. Ruth was so committed to her mother-in-law that she put herself in exactly the same conditions that Naomi was in. And she's not done yet. Thy people shall be my people. Just consider the depth of that statement. Think of the impact that it would have on mission work if a missionary was willing to move his citizenship to the country that he was serving. Think of the stir that it would cause if this missionary would choose to live in a bamboo hut and adapt to the daily routine of the native people. Several years ago, a UPS driver was talking to one of my coworkers, and he was sharing about his Christian life. He doesn't attend church very often, though. All they talk about is money, he said. They just want my money, and they're always asking questions about my personal life. He said that his friends mostly aren't church people. Thy people shall be my people. I have friends that aren't Christians too, and we talk about things. We talk about hunting and fishing and sports, but you know, there is something missing. There's a whole level that's missing. There are some things that we just can't really relate on. My closest friends are Christians. I believe that when a person accepts Jesus as their Lord and Savior, his friends will soon change. As we move on, we find Ruth making the deepest commitment yet. Thy God shall be my God. This is very personal because this is where she puts her trust and where she has her confidence. The Moabites worshiped Chemosh, a god of fertility. From little up, Ruth had heard that when you were suffering from sickness and when you needed rain, when bad things were happening to you, when you were waiting for a harvest, you worshiped Chemosh. Her parents believed it with all their hearts. Her relatives practiced it. Their whole village sacrificed faithfully to Chemosh. It might have seemed repetitious and futile sometimes, but you know, after a while it would rain and then the problems would go away. And if they didn't, well, maybe he was still displeased. It's very hard to abandon your deepest, earliest beliefs. But Ruth turned her back on Chemosh and turned to the God of Israel. This was 100% commitment. Remember the story in Genesis 31, how Rachel stole her father's idols when Jacob and his family left Laban. I don't really know this, but I wonder, I'm curious about why she took her father's idols. I think that Rachel worshiped the God of her husband. But apparently, I think it's quite possible that she wasn't certain that he was the only true God. She was taking some of these idols as a connection to what she had grown up believing in, just in case. But that was not Ruth. Ruth's commitment was complete. Up to this point, Ruth's intentions could be checked up on by Naomi. Later on, if Ruth was failing to live up to her commitment, Naomi could challenge her. Naomi could remind her. But now Ruth changes direction a little. And these two stages, the last two stages, come after Naomi's death. Where thou diest, she said, will I die. I think if they would encounter some really bad trouble on the trip and Naomi would die, Ruth was not going to run away to try to save herself. Rather, she is willing to die trying to help Naomi. But if things didn't work out the way they hoped in Bethlehem, and they, you know, it wasn't so good there, and they didn't find food or shelter, the people rejected them, and Naomi would die there, Ruth was going to stay. She would not return to Moab, even if returning was her only hope of survival. Naomi was likely older than Ruth, and therefore Ruth expected that she would outlive Naomi. She wanted to assure Naomi that Bethlehem was now her home. The people of Israel were now her people. Ruth would be as out of place in Moab as Naomi had been there. So Ruth pledged to remain in Israel until she died. Finally, Ruth says that she would be buried where Naomi is buried as well. If all goes as planned, this would be in Bethlehem. But that part of the pledge outlasts even Ruth. Even after she died, Ruth would remain with Naomi. This might seem a little unnecessary to us, but Ruth was trying to prove to Naomi the depth of her commitment. She already has accepted Naomi's people as her own. Now Ruth says that her commitment is good even after her death. None of her current family would feel obligated to bury Ruth next to her parents in Moab. I can see Ruth burning some bridges here. Usually people advise us not to burn bridges whenever we part ways with family or friends or employers or something. But I think that sometimes burning bridges is a good idea, especially where it relates to a commitment. Even if Ruth would have had a moment of weakness and she could have wavered in her commitment, she will not go back because she has cut off all those ties with her past. Ruth made a commitment, not simply to herself, but she spoke it out loud. She heard it, and Naomi heard it. Nobody made her do it or coaxed her into it. It was her decision. I think sometimes whenever we read verse 18, we might read that Ruth was stubborn or strong-willed, and Naomi finally just gave up trying to argue with her. Naomi wasn't going to argue anymore. We've all met people like that before. But I believe this verse is saying so much more than that. Naomi saw that Ruth was indeed committed. She had a strong conviction to her desire. And when Naomi saw that, I think she must have smiled, if not outwardly, but inwardly. There was really nothing more that needed to be said. Naomi had what she wanted. Finally, I'd like to look at some of the benefits of making a commitment. First, there are personal benefits, benefits for the person who makes a commitment. Now that Ruth has chosen a direction that she's going to go, she has purpose in life. She has a goal to work toward. She can throw all of her energies into getting there. You see, Ruth had been on the fence, and as long as we're riding the fence, we tend not to get off until we need to, until we have to. We will not make a commitment if it's possible to continue to stall. People shy away from making a commitment because they like to keep their options open, and we all do that because they like their freedom. But actually settling on a course of action and making a commitment gives us purpose and meaning in life. Now we really do have true freedom. Freedom to pour ourselves 100% into the decision that we've made. There's also the benefit of accountability. By publicly stating the commitment, Ruth is not free to make a revision at some later time. She and Naomi both heard what she said, and she meant what she said, and that in itself gives strength to help carry it out. There's also benefits of our commitment that extend to those around us. Human relationships are built on trust, and those relationships grow as our confidence grows in the trustworthiness of those around us. Trust develops because we see people making promises and then acting to carry them out. Because of Ruth's commitment and her efforts to live it out every day, Naomi could have complete confidence in Ruth, and she would feel security being with Ruth. That's what our marriages ought to be like. That's what our church family ought to be like. If you know that your brother and sisters here in this church has made a commitment just like Ruth did, then you know that they have your back. You're confident that they're praying for you. You're certain that they won't be spreading gossip about you. When one person has made a commitment, it tends to encourage others around them to grow in their own commitments. The Declaration of Independence ends with these words: "And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor." I believe that that commitment is what makes the Declaration of Independence so strong. One thing about Ruth that caught God's attention was her commitment. How does our commitment benefit God? God is constantly working in our lives. The scripture tells us that, to develop patience. Because patience during trials produces character. Romans 5, 3 through 5, and James 1, 2 to 4 tell us about the testing of our faith producing patience. Hebrews 5, 5 through 10 tells us that Jesus learned obedience by the things which he suffered, and that he was made perfect through suffering. Hebrews 2:10 tells us that God made Jesus, the captain of our salvation, perfect through his suffering. How much do you think that we would read about Daniel and Job and Joseph and David and Paul and many others if they had not been committed to trusting and being obedient and faithful to God no matter what? God needs each one of us to make commitments and then to stick with them diligently, or else we will never get to see God's faithfulness. A commitment really is not all that hard to make, but it goes completely against our human nature. Naomi was not willing to let these two girls trail along with her just because it was the right thing to do. She demanded a commitment, and because she would settle for nothing less, that's what she got. And what a blessing that commitment has produced for us. One reason we don't see people making commitments today is because so many around us are getting away with a total lack of commitment. But God highly values those who are bold enough to stand alone with a commitment. You remember the story of Rahab. Rahab was Ruth's other mother-in-law. In Joshua 2, we read about the men of Jericho. It says that they had lost all their courage, that their hearts had melted. They were terrified. Everyone was convinced that Israel's God was the true God and that he was going to destroy them. But only Rahab was willing to step out and make a commitment. And God found a place for her in that family as well. One woman from Jericho, one woman from Moab. But God crafted a plan to get both of them out of where they were and into a place where he could use them. In 2014, the Church of the Brethren reported a membership of 114,000 people. However, that same year, the average attendance for weekly worship services was only 50,600. 42% of the denomination, only 42%, had enough interest in worship to go to the bother of attending church regularly. That number is down from 47% 5 years earlier. I thought about that for a while. I know that there are numerous factors that go into those kind of numbers. Some members are older. You have members here who don't attend church regularly. People that aren't able to get around like they once did. But I suspect that commitment plays a significant role in those numbers. Membership numbers have been declining in the Church of the Brethren for more than 50 years, and church leaders are concerned about those declining numbers. So they made it easier to become brethren. And since membership doesn't cost as much today as what it used to, it's not valued very much either. I was on a Bible quizzing team for Montgomery, the church that I grew up with at Montgomery Brethren in Christ Church, for 2 years after I graduated from high school. And that first year, we had a final competition was held at Taylor University in Indiana. The president of that school addressed the group of quizzers at the awards ceremony. And I still remember parts of what he said. He said that in this day, with such busy schedules and with so many things going on in the lives of young people and so many opportunities, he frequently heard parents and coaches suggesting that maybe it was time to cut back on the amount of material that quizzers needed to study. Back then, that particular year, we were quizzed on the entire book of Matthew. So it's a lot of work, a lot of material. It was a real struggle for people to keep up. But I still remember the passion in his response. He was almost crying as he said, in days like these, days like these were no time to lower our expectations for people. He said, if anything, he believed we ought to be asking more out of people as the days got busier. That's what I want to challenge you with this morning. Our churches might have more members if we make it easier to get in. But we will have, at that point, we will just have more people that we're not sure we can depend on. It's not easy to make a commitment today. We would rather stay on the fence. But when we're on the fence, see, whenever we're riding the fence, we can very quickly move from one side to the other. It's no harder to move one way or the other based on whatever our circumstances are. Today we need more people, more men, to be like Joshua. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. We need more people, more women, who will say along with Ruth, the Lord do so to me, and more also, if aught but death part me and thee. At this time, we'd like to sing two verses of a hymn of invitation. I don't know what decisions you might have in front of you, what you might be riding the fence about. But if the Holy Spirit has been speaking to you, then I believe you know what it is that you ought to do. It's not really a question of what is the right thing to do, but rather the question is, will you submit to God, or do you want to continue to call the shots? You can continue to hold out. You can stay on the fence, but you won't really begin to live until you have allowed Him to have full control. What shall we sing for an invitation? Just probably just two verses.